Investors Chronicle.
Welcome back to the Companies and Markets Show. Joining me in the studio, we've got Mark Robinson, Alex Newman, and Dave Baxter, and over the line, Julian Hoffman as well, all hosted as normal by Dan Jones. Dan, hello. How are you?
I'm well, thanks, John. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What is coming up on today's show?
Yeah, we've got a busy show today, a lot to pack in. We're going to start by talking about retailers and various retail-facing companies, some of the high-profile problems there from the likes of Cineworld, AOworld, and beyond. We're going to then pivot seamlessly to a little bit on oil services, a couple of companies reporting this week, and commodities in general, a couple of interesting mining details to pick out that we will be talking about. And then we'll be looking at our cover feature as ever. Jennifer Johnson is going to be here to talk about blockbuster drugs. And finally, we will be discussing with Dave, our funds editor, our Hargreaves exclusive story this week on the fee deals that they have been offering certain customers, or one customer in particular.
Great. Yes, busy show. And before we get there, a little roundup of the week of news. It's midday on Thursday as we speak, Thursday the 25th of August, and that means traders are poised for the beginning of the Jackson Hole Wyoming conference, which will be underway for you now, listener. The conference sees central bankers congregating, including US Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell, to discuss the challenges ahead for the global economy. Companies news, London-listed Cineworld, the second largest cinema business in the world, confirmed it is looking at bankruptcy options. Shares have lost 98% of their value over the last 5 years. However, they have reiterated that it expects operations to continue after any bankruptcy filing. Chris Akers with the write-up for the IC online and in the magazine. Vodafone has agreed to sell its Hungary business for a £1.5 billion fee. The cash will go into helping finance infrastructure and 5G upgrades. In February, Vodafone rejected a multi-million pound bid for its Italian business, so eyes are peeled for further movement there in the future, in the near future. Car and bike retailer Halfords saw its share price tumble 10% following a cut in the target share price by broker Panmure Gordon. The company warned at its half-year results that inflationary pressures would hit sales, and the broker has said in a new note the damage would be significant. French multinational company Schneider Electric said it is thinking of a full takeover of UK software company Aviva. That's Aviva with an E in the middle, not to be confused with the insurer Aviva. Schneider already owns 60% of the business. A couple of slightly longer reads to highlight this week. Mitchell Labiak looks at how Frasers has defied the inflationary environment to see shares surge. The Sports Direct owner swung from a £78 million pre-tax loss last year to a £297 million profit in its most recent trading update. It's also added a string of acquisitions to its stable, including an investment in Hugo Boss. That read is available online and in the mag now. And in an exclusive, Dave Baxter writes about a secret fee deal an investor got to stay with Hargreaves Lansdown. And we are talking about that at the end of the podcast. So stay tuned for that. That's all from me. Over to you, Dan.
Thank you, John. Yes, we are going to start in the world of retailers. Cineworld, a very high profile company and a high profile near collapse there. But there's some wider issues here as well, obviously. It's a much tougher environment in general for retailers coming into the second half. Interest rates are rising. You know, the cost of debt is going up. Refinancing suddenly becomes a lot more tricky, perhaps, if you're looking at this now than you were 12 months ago. There's no perhaps about it, really. And there's a few strands to pick out here. Alex Newman, our ideas editor, is with us. Alex, Cineworld is the most obvious example there, but we're talking about a couple of things in print this week. Carnival being another one, retail facing, of course. And we've had AOworld as well recently, you know, with a bit of a fundraise, you know, got to get that all important working capital up to speed. So there are some, you know, canaries in the coal mine again here, really.
Yeah, I suppose we should point out that each situation there is different.
Sure.
And AOworld, I'd say, despite their struggles, Of the names you mentioned there, I would worry least about, though, you know, that company, given the fundraising looks to be sort of done deal. The strands you mentioned there, which we can sort of tie together in the current environment, is basically that, you know, there's lots of companies are warning that sales are going to be slowing, going to face all these macroeconomic headwinds. And if companies have been reliant in the last few years on debt to fund their growth, it's not that easy to, you know, when we've got this very, very abrupt change in circumstances over the last years, necessarily to refinance that debt as it comes due. So, I mean, Cineworld is the extreme example of this because they had so many liabilities and, you know, they've really been kicking the can down for some time now. And so that's why we've seen in the last week with the talk of a potential bankruptcy proceedings and you know, almost skipping past a full restructuring of the business. That's how dire the situation is there. Carnival, which you mentioned, I think is a really interesting example here. Again, I mean, they're a supremely leveraged company and investors have been willing to back them, you know, sensing this long-term growth in the cruise business. But they face a really interesting sort of juncture whereby debt markets are possibly closing their doors to them because the, you know, interest rates are rising considerably. And the risk that borrowers are willing to take on is the risk profile there has changed quite dramatically. What they'd be asking for is a real pound of flesh, a sort of double digit bond, sort of bond coupons, etc. So if that happens, then we have this really worrying situation for equity investors in that, you know, if they're going to have to go cap in hand and ask for an equity injection, at what price that is done is kind of anyone's guess when the outlook is, you know, is so choppy for, you know, share price returns. So, I mean, that's kind of a sort of blanket overview of the things that are happening there. But it's certainly a trend to watch in the second half of the year for companies which are quite highly leveraged, running into a little bit of sales difficulty, which might not feel, what might not find debt markets quite as supportive as they have been. That, you know, that dynamic can be really, really brutal for share prices, even if it doesn't mean that we're going to see the kind of Cineworld style collapses en masse.
AO Worldwide, as you say, is perhaps slightly different, but that was particularly interesting from the point of view of an investor, it seemed to me, because that was almost one of those where it's hard to pick up ahead of time, other than, you know, looking at, you know, there are some liabilities there, and obviously working capital is really important for retailers. But this was a case of, well, it seemed, I think they said this wasn't prompted by this, but, you know, there were stories about their credit insurance for suppliers being withdrawn, well, or at least, you know, the collateral raised there, which meant the suppliers would then need to demand payment up front, which obviously then creates a bit of a cash crunch. And, you know, it's quite hard until those stories come out to anticipate these kind of things ahead of time.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mark wrote the results up a week ago. He said, you know, the operationally, it's kind of fell under the heading of not quite as dismal as expected. But yeah, we have these kind of liquidity supply chain issues, which, the kind of the insurance and, you know, capital market infrastructure, which often underpins quite complicated middleman style businesses, you know, they're showing some serious signs of stress. And yeah, that's hard to predict or spot from from the outside. So
I guess what you're saying as well, Alex, is that it increases the imperative to look at the debt breakdown as well if you're an investor.
Yeah,
because, you know, this might all blow over in 2 or 3 years, who can say? But you know, as ever, take heed of the notes.
And also, you know, I think the companies which have been upfront about the timing of when debts are likely to mature is kind of fully disclosed. But something, you know, investors should really be paying attention to is, you know, what have companies said about how they've hedged their energy costs? What are, you know, what are their kind of soundings been on from their bankers, if that information is, you know, is being disclosed? Because, you know, everyone's staring down a quite difficult year ahead. And if a refinancing is coming in January or March or April or whatever it is, and the market's now saying, yeah, interest rates by then are going to be 4%, then that's going to add a huge dollop to interest payments come this time next year.
And on a general retail point as well, so far what we've seen during the results season is that companies have been relatively successful in passing costs through. But obviously that must reach a point where that grinds up against household budgets. And I guess that's, you know, we'll probably have to wait until Q1 trading updates, or rather 3Q trading updates, to see what's happening on that score. But as I say, you know, it can't go on forever passing through costs.
Well, you're already seeing a sort of consumer strike in the US in certain areas. I did a piece on this for the news section this week's mag. For example, like home improvement, for example, people are just putting off doing anything to their houses because they're having to pay more in their mortgages, which probably spares the houses from a kind of terrible makeover, but isn't very good for the likes of, Home Depot or Lowe's or something. Depends very much on your customer base. I think that's definitely what we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah. I think there seems to be resilience there, even in some of those companies. But yeah, there is the question of how long that can last as well.
I mean, a lot of hangovers as well, obviously, from the pandemic. With three of the companies we mentioned there had differing outcomes as a result. AO World was quite positive while that was going on. But obviously, Cineworld, it's a definite hangover. And I think Chris, in his article, or certainly when I was speaking to him, pointed out the fact that there have been relatively few blockbusters this year, which is a contributory factor as well. I mean, you know, from the macro through to the micro.
There ought to be a business there, though, isn't there? I mean, if someone picks that up on the cheap now, that if they go down, I mean, presumably free of debt, that business could be quite successful. I mean, nobody has ever wooed anyone by saying, oh, would you like to come around and watch Netflix?
Yeah. I'm quite, presume there are not going to be too many people listening who are still holders of Cineworld, because it has been, you know, in a dire straits for a long time. But I'm, you know, yeah, I kind of agree with that. You know, there has been a problem this year with blockbusters and, you know, just a lack of things coming through. You've had kind of the tentpole things like Top Gun, but really this summer, there were kind of weeks on end where there was nothing new coming out, which is very rare. And even, you know, I could spend a long time talking about the lack of non-blockbuster films now, but blockbusters is where the money is made. And if you look at like next year's schedule, I think trade publications have seen some suggestion that there isn't much coming out next year either. But it seems to me that almost any franchise you can think of has a sequel coming out next year, or more than one. So
I think the main draw of cinemas this winter is going to be if they are heated.
You know. Yeah, well,
that's the place to just gather en masse with your fellow cinema goers.
I mean, it's much the same in the past few weeks. The aircon in the cinema has been a bonus in some ways. So yeah, maybe there's
you kind of feel-good comedies are going to be the thing this year, aren't they?
Well, yeah. That's another thing, that there's very few comedies made nowadays because everyone funnels the money into TV.
Horror movies as well increased during times of economic stress. God knows why, but it's been proven in the past.
Yeah. We shall see. But yeah, the business model itself is perhaps not entirely broken, but certainly some difficulties there. Let's move on, because we do have a lot to discuss this week. Oil services, very different in one way, but in another, looking at a couple of companies reported in the past couple of weeks, Wood Group and Hunting. Two different stories there. Hunting reports today, or has reported today as we are recording, and results have been very well received. Wood Group, a little bit of the opposite. You know, it's still working through these legacy issues. It does have itself, you know, a decent amount of debt as well. It's just an interesting contrast there, I suppose. You know, I was speaking to Alex Hamer, our commodities guru, and, you know, making the point that Hunting is a lot more nimble, doesn't have, you know, the legacy project exposure and can kind of tap into the oil boom more easily. But it's interesting that, you know, it doesn't translate for Wood Group into great results.
Yeah, I think the point with Hunting, because I've looked at the company for a number of years now, and for years it was very well run, had sort of great IP, but it's largely exposed to the unconventional oil and gas market, particularly in North America as well. That's starting to come back a bit now. The Biden administration have been fairly negative on oil and gas since he came to power. But I think because of the ongoing energy crisis, perhaps federal government sort of attitudes are changing. And a point with Hunting as well, it falls under the general oil services stroke equipment heading, but it's a specialist, or has a high proportion linked in directional drilling, fracking technologies, and that's great when you've got a high well count and that's increasing. But unlike some other oil services companies, when the market is down, it doesn't have the maintenance work or high-level maintenance work it can fall back on. And so that's why it's really suffered whenever the oil price has slumped and production has slumped. So it's a little bit unconventional itself in that regard.
Yeah. And Wood Group, thoughts, you know, it's been struggling again with a lot of these big projects that it's been trying to wean itself off of.
Yeah. I think that's the case. I mean, what Alex points to, and you mentioned that it's the legacy issues with the company itself. And I think the general view of the market is that it's a holding position at the moment. It's only one thing that they get through, when they get through these, that you'll be able to sort of have a reasoned valuation.
You know, we can spend a bit of time on oil services, but the commodities, you know, complex in general is pretty broad. And another interesting aspect of that, you know, in turning to the miners, is Anglo Pacific Group, which is not really a company that's particularly high profile, but it is one we sort of picked up on in recent weeks as a potential beneficiary of, in some ways, you know, a more stringent regulatory environment for some of the bigger companies. Obviously, there's a lot of talk right now about whether you be oil or mining or whatever, about, you know, windfall profits and things like that. But Alex, do you want to talk a bit about the potential opportunity there?
Very briefly, Anglo Pacific is a company we've followed for many years, but they are a royalty and streaming company which derives most of its income still from a concession over a coal mine in Queensland, which is the aforementioned beneficiary benefiting from a regulatory change point you just mentioned there, Dan. But one of the nice aspects of Anglo Pacific's business model is that they don't have to get into the nitty gritty and operational pain and capital cycles that most miners do, which, you know, there are often many downsides to when prices aren't so strong. But as when prices are really strong, as we've seen recently, there can also be problems because the political pressure and conversation around windfall taxes rises, and that has been affected in Queensland, where the government there has taken a kind of a super windfall cut on explosive thermal and coking coal prices. The structure of Anglo Pacific's royalty stream over the Queensland mine is such that they take whatever the government is going to take, which basically is leading to just ballooning profits from that stream. Smartly, they've said for a while now that they know this is going to run out in sort of 2026 or so, that they are reinvesting lots of those profits into, you know, future facing metal streams and commodity projects. So they've announced a number of deals this year, including they're focusing on nickel, cobalt, sort of minerals and metals which are going to be in heavy use in the energy transition and electric vehicles.
There's a copper mine in Chile as well.
Yeah, and copper as well. So they, you know, this is quite. There are obviously controversies about any company that's deriving any profit from coal, and lots of investors, that's just a complete non-starter. But, you know, if we're going to get to a cleaner energy and material system, then one way to do that is to recycle profits that are being generated from our kind of legacy fossil fuel system into the new one. And as kind of pretty much precisely what Anglo Pacific is doing. So yeah, and they had results out today, very, very strong. They're just throwing off so much cash from this Queensland royalty that they're able to reduce net debt, and they're looking to plow that back into new acquisitions as well as supporting a dividend of one and three quarters of a pence per share, which is, you know, very, very easily covered at the moment.
Yeah, copper in itself is a bit of a no-brainer at the moment. As you say, it's integral to the sort of the ambitions towards net zero and the expansion of electric motoring as well. Yeah. And plus, you know, grades around the globe have been falling, and they've been falling for a decade or so now, which has increased the sort of the capital costs involved in these mines too. And it's just going to be supportive of the price for decades to come, one imagines.
I mean, you've got the interesting dynamic, haven't you, in the short term, you know, some of the economic issues mean, you know, some of the price of a lot of these resources is coming down. But yeah, you've got that structural impulse there. Although that said, it was quite interesting this week looking at obviously the EV electric car production. Cobalt, for example, is another one where the price has come down on the short term and supply is obviously increasing because people see those opportunities. But it's interesting, the number of batteries in electric cars that use cobalt have actually started to fall quite a lot as well, possibly because supply has been constrained for a while. So, on the demand side, manufacturers are finding ways around, and it may be, the basics of, there's going to be more demand for all these things, I'm sure are correct, but it may be that the exact share of these things, changes a bit, and it's not in a one-to-one, mining X metal for years in the future means it's going to be a winner.
I mean, the cobalt is one that battery manufacturers definitely be keen to diversify or kind of hedge against, given that, so much supply comes from the Congo. Yeah. So it's not a country that you would, if you're reliant on those supply chains, that you're going to feel hugely confident about, given its history and the enormous stresses on that country. So yeah, I mean, the Anglo-Pacific's cobalt stream that they've invested in is in, or a development stream is in Brazil. That's an alternative supply, which is probably good news then.
Our cover feature this week is on blockbuster drugs and what the next blockbuster drugs might be, how one can spot a blockbuster drug, and so on and so forth. Difficult questions to answer, but our correspondent Jennifer Johnson has attempted to do that. Jen, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's good to be here.
Yeah, I should say also this is a pre-recorded segment, so we are coming to you from 1 week in the past because Jen's about to go on holiday. Before you go, you're on the podcast for the first time. Why don't we talk a bit about sort of the thinking behind the feature, what kind of things you were trying to explore?
So blockbuster drugs are extremely important to, the revenues of most big pharmaceutical companies. They make up anywhere between sort of 45% and 83% of sales among the five biggest pharma companies. So when those drugs go off patent, meaning that generic manufacturers are allowed to make copies of the drug, those original manufacturers lose revenue. And with so many companies being so dependent on blockbuster drugs, it's very important to take a look at the pipelines and the drugs that these companies are developing, because you can see quite a significant drop off in profits once a drug has sort of fallen off what's known as the patent cliff.
Yeah, we should say the blockbuster drugs, for the purposes that we and I think most people define them, are drugs with $1 billion of sales a year. So, the big money spinners for these companies. And as we know, pharma, invest huge amounts in R&D to try and ensure they have a decent stream of new products coming online. Easier said than done. There are a lot of pitfalls out there. I suppose, when you think of, medicines and vaccines now, just saying that word obviously makes everyone think of the pandemic and coronavirus vaccinations. mRNA is what I'm effectively leading onto here. Obviously, that was a big breakthrough. A lot was invested in a short space of time, understandably, which helped achieve those breakthroughs. But the mRNA technology is one that some pharma companies have been, looking at for some time. Some of them have got big hopes in other areas too, in terms of utilizing that elsewhere.
Yeah. So I guess with mRNA, the best place to start is by kind of understanding what it's designed to do. And this is going to be quite a bit of a scientific simplification, but essentially mRNA orders the body's cells to make specific proteins, which can then be mobilized in a number of different ways. So with the COVID vaccines, your body is instructed to mobilize against the coronavirus. But as you said, researchers have been working with mRNA for decades. And until the coronavirus vaccines came around, cancer was going to be always thought to be its potential kind of largest application. It's the idea is that if you're given an mRNA cancer vaccine, your body is directed to attack your tumor cells. And so there are quite a lot of companies working on mRNA cancer vaccines for all different types of cancers. You've also got companies now working on other respiratory viruses like the flu. AstraZeneca is even working on a cardiovascular drug that would essentially promote the regeneration of blood vessels around the heart, which have been damaged by high blood pressure or a heart attack. So it's an mRNA treatment for heart failure, essentially. So the COVID vaccines are probably the first time that members of the general public heard of mRNA, but its potential applications are huge. And it's definitely a technology that has blockbuster, i.e. billion-dollar potential and much more.
You know, we talk about cancer there, and obviously that would be, you know, a kind of holy grail of drug development. But it also speaks to the difficulties in this whole process. You know, you've got, you know, find a big target market, if you want to use that term. Maybe I'm being a bit too crude there, but, you know, you've got a big opportunity, but also, you know, whatever disease it is, you've got to get through trials. You've also got to make sure it's costed, it's priced in the right kind of way. You know, how big a impediment can that be in some cases? You know, because these drugs cost a lot to develop and in some cases cost much more to buy.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is an important topic to discuss now, especially in relation to cancer, because cancer isn't really one disease. It's a number of different diseases. Yeah. The rarer that a cancer is, the more difficult historically it's been to find an effective treatment. And obviously the smaller a given market is, the more expensive these drugs are going to be for patients and for healthcare systems. I guess the holy grail of cancer drugs was once thought to be a cure for cancer, but now it's more effective precision treatments that are dealing with, you know, the genetic factors that go into kind of individual cancers. But obviously, as these treatments become highly personalized, they will be more expensive. And so it's one of those things, you know, just because a drug is highly expensive doesn't mean it won't become a blockbuster. But the willingness of insurers and patients and healthcare systems to pay for these drugs very much depends upon their efficacy. Healthcare systems as a whole are willing to pick up the tab on a highly, highly effective drug if it's going to make a significant difference, i.e. save a patient's life or significantly prolong their life or significantly improve their quality of life. So it's not the case that really expensive drugs can't go on to be successful, but if they're coming in at a high price point, they sort of have to prove that they're valuable.
I suppose that leads on to another thing you talk about in the piece, which is, you know, orphan drugs, the orphan drug market, these, you know, specific areas with relatively rare conditions, but nonetheless there's some potential there now as well for some interesting development.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you look at it from a pharma company's perspective, the kind of most popular, highest selling drugs of last year, I believe, one of them is a drug that treats a number of different autoimmune diseases called Humira. So it treats arthritis and psoriasis. So that has a huge potential market, or a huge market that it does serve. The other kind of biggest blockbuster in recent years is a blood thinner, which is something, again, that has multiple applications in multiple diseases. But if you're going to try and break into a market that's already well served by effective treatments, that's going to be very expensive and quite a difficult scientific hurdle to cross. So increasingly, pharma companies are interested in what are known as orphan diseases. And that is kind of a little bit, I guess, of a crass term for highly rare diseases. And there are some statistics from Evaluate Pharma, which is a data provider for the sector, that say by 2026, orphan drug sales will account for 1/5 of all prescription sales, and that the top 10 orphan drugs will be worth between $3 billion and $13 billion. So these are drugs that are going to be coming in at a very high price point, because they're going to be serving these very small markets of patients with rare diseases.
And shifting away from, you know, the orphan market to a potentially huge market, another area you talk about is Alzheimer's and the quest and the to find something, you know, useful there, and the difficulties that companies have had in trying to develop products for that.
Yeah, so that has been Alzheimer's, and the development of Alzheimer's drugs has been particularly difficult for a US company called Biogen, who last year received accelerated approval from the FDA for a drug which is now kind of widely considered to be a flop for a number of different reasons. But it kind of boils down to the fact that the drug, while it did what it said it would do, which is reduce plaques of something called beta amyloid in the brain, it didn't necessarily improve the lives of Alzheimer's patients. And all kind of Alzheimer's treatments, not all, but most of them that are under development at the moment, and there are quite a few, including another by Biogen, one that's going to be releasing phase three trial results in the next year. These drugs all work to reduce these plaques in the brain, but there's not scientific consensus over whether that is necessarily the root cause of Alzheimer's. So these are quite high risk potentially drugs, and we won't really know until more of this class of drug have released phase three trial results. So that's the last trial stage before a drug would go into approval. But yeah, it's potentially, if one of these drugs does prove that it works and that reducing these plaques in the brain also improves Alzheimer's symptoms, that is a massive, massive market. So whoever kind of cracks this first is going to be in with a real blockbuster drug.
Yeah. And that, you know, brings us on to the US in general, which obviously, you know, goes without saying is, you know, the big pharma market, the big pharma companies are over there. It's a market, obviously, you know well. But in the last, you know, couple of weeks, we have had some developments there, which we touched on in last week's issue around Medicare and drug pricing and the impact that the quote-unquote Inflation Reduction Act could have on some existing drug sales. Can we talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so in the Inflation Reduction Act is a measure that would allow Medicare, which is the government's health insurance policy that mostly covers people over 65, and would allow representatives of Medicare to negotiate prices initially of 10 drugs for or on behalf of Medicare users. And this has caused some controversy in the pharmaceutical industry because it does have the potential to kind of take the wind out of some blockbuster sales per se. But there are also arguments that say it won't actually be that big of a deal. You know, 63 million people in the US are on Medicare. As of 2020, you've had something like 177 who use private health insurance. So while the Medicare market is significant, I think it's probably just under one fifth of the US population uses it. It's not necessarily the be all and end all, but the drugs that could potentially be impacted by eventual price controls, which would come into effect in 2026, I think negotiations start, are blockbusters, which are used by a lot of people, especially older people. So it kind of remains to be seen what impact this will have on pharma revenues in the long term. In the short term, it's kind of removed this element of headline risk because I think the sector was anticipating price control regulations of some variety. But now that those have become clear, I think markets are kind of breathing a little bit of a sigh of relief and trying to get their heads around what this actually means. And we won't really know. We don't even know yet which are the 10 drugs. There's kind of a lot of speculation around which ones are likely to be negotiated upon. But yeah, it's a sort of watch this space thing because there are potentially a couple of companies that could lose out on serious revenue.
Yeah, we do have, as I say, details of that in last week's issue. But yeah, as you mentioned, you know, 2026, it is a while away, but nonetheless, markets always forward looking and got to be cognizant of these issues and these risks. But yes, the blockbuster drugs feature is the cover story in this week's issue. Look out for that on the shelves this week, as usual. For our final section this week, we are talking to Dave Baxter, our funds editor, about platform fees and Hargreaves Lansdown in particular, a story out on the IC website and in print a couple of days ago. Dave, do you want to sort of talk us through the basics of the piece first of all, and then we can get into the detail?
Yeah, absolutely. We were speaking to a Hargreaves customer, or perhaps soon to be former customer, who after about 10 years with the platform decided to leave. And interestingly, what happened is Hargreaves then turned to him and offered him a kind of discounted version of the fees, you know, the standard fee structure that he was paying on funds that he held. Yeah, and that's kind of that is something that they have done in the past, but it's really not well publicized at all. It's not a thing that many people are aware of. And it's just interesting to see, particularly at this time, given, you know, for me, two factors stand out. So one is, of course, you know, cost of living. People are starting to feel that and may now be considering just how much of a difference they can get in costs if they move a relatively large pot from someone like Hargreaves to someone like Interactive Investor, which is what this customer is doing. And then on the other hand, just more generally, I imagine you might be seeing the effects of rivals like Interactive and AJ Bell and others. You know, they're becoming more prominent, and now people are perhaps finally starting to question whether they, you know, whether they still want to be paying those kind of higher fees to be with Hargreaves, as they many have done for a long time.
Yeah. The other interesting thing I took from it as well was, you know, this customer had a pot, you know, a few hundred thousand, but sad to say, almost, that's not, you know, the very biggest kind of pot. So it's not the absolute, you know, premium kind of customer. It's certainly, you know, a very valuable customer, I'm sure, on a lot of assets there. But it's almost like, you know, there is the question of, you know, if they're offering that kind of customer a deal, and I'm sure it's only in isolated cases, it's not every time, that you know, what does that say about, you know, the strategy in general? But I mean, that's speculation, isn't it, in terms of, you know, what might be going on there.
I would agree with that. I mean, my initial assumption when we first kind of spoke to this individual was, you know, we originally didn't know how much of a pot they had. And my assumption was, you know, we're perhaps talking a million plus. You'd think for Hargreaves to kind of bend on their fees and to make that compromise, it would have to be a fairly chunky amount. I mean, you can argue that, you know, it's expensive to acquire customers and any money retained is still a good thing. But yeah, perhaps, like you say, they're increasingly trying to kind of hold on to what they can, and maybe those kind of relatively smaller parts are now more important and more worth them kind of focusing on.
Mm. Well, yeah.
I mean, to me, it smells a bit like desperation. I mean, you saw that in the results, that they're experiencing a lot of pricing pressure. So, I mean, if they're having to go this far down the ladder in order to retain people, then there must be a serious issue. But I mean, again, that's only a speculative, but you can see that the margins are under pressure.
Yeah. I mean, the margins, yeah, they obviously were very high for a long time and they have come down. They're still pretty high, but, you know, at the same time, you know, in the first half, I was just looking the other day as well, you know, the obviously client acquisition is tough in this market in general, but in terms of client retention, they, you know, they matched the first half of 2021, which, yeah, given, you know, everything going on there and, you know, a bit more boom time, well, certainly a lot more boom time feel to it, that was pretty creditable. So there isn't really a sign, the margins are definitely under pressure, but there isn't really a sign on the retention side that there's been an issue so far. So yeah, it is a question of how far this goes and what it means.
And that's an extremely high figure, isn't it? I looked at it the other day and it's something like, was it 92%? Mm. Or it's you know, yeah, breathtakingly high. So you think, perhaps they are doing more of this kind of deal activity, and perhaps that is kind of helping them to hold on to that retention rate for the time being.
There's a possibility as well that retail investors may be following the institutions and bumping up their cash accounts a little bit, their liquidity. And I knew Hargreaves were under criticism in the past of what they do when they've got the dormant funds sitting in there. Presumably that goes out to short-term money markets and the like. But in the past, their actual customers saw very little of this return. I think there was a change earlier on this year to that effect, but that was primarily a result of criticism.
Mm. I think, as we should also say, you know, this has happened in the past and we don't know how widespread it is. And perhaps, you know, more people are going to be finding out on the back of this story. But I think the last time it was kind of really highlighted was, and even then it was, you know, quite under the radar, was early 2014. That was back after the retail distribution review and the sort of the change in pricing of that enacted. So that was at a time when prices had changed, and maybe it's just coincidence that it's resurfacing now at a time when, you know, pricing's under pressure again, but we'll see. You can read more about that online and in print, and we will be covering platforms a lot more as we continue to do this year in the next few weeks. The final thing I suppose we should say as well is that the difficulty for all platform customers still is the transferring process itself is pretty difficult. You know, those transfer times are difficult. So that is plays to incumbents. There have definitely been improvements there, but I know that's still a big bugbear for a lot of people. So we'll see how all these things continue to interact. But on that note, that brings us to the end of a packed show. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you to our guests, Dave, Alex, Julian, Mark, Jen, and John. And we will see you again next week for another Companies and Markets show.